Mary Washington College. In 1994, got his PhD in history from Johns Hopkins University in 2003. He is now at the University of Mary Washington as professor of history and American studies, as well as chief of staff to the president. Because of limited time remaining, I will stop there, but we're very lucky to have you. And there's the topic.
I have.
Was that synced up this evening? It doesn't sound like it's synced up.
What?
Was it synced up to the receiver?
Well,
I don't know. How's it sound?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. Turn
it on.
Yeah. See, he knows where to put it. Maybe we'll come in and put it down on the recording button.
Seemed like this was a family event, but thank you to Mark and all the Marks that have made this possible tonight. I'm honored to be here, but I have to just say this is a really impressive organization. I've been to a lot of places to give talks, and the work that you all are doing is really just incredibly noteworthy, and you should I hope you realize that the work that you're doing to preserve and extend the history of the Civil War era is just it's essential. So thank you for that. My topic tonight is Going Home, War's End, and although I didn't bring any copies of my book, it is available on Amazon. You know, from April to July of 1865, we know that Confederate soldiers returned to their homes, and they returned to their homes in a variety of ways. They're paroled by Union forces, they're left on their own. In some cases, they were released from Union prisons. There weren't trains to take them home. There was rarely money to ease their path. So like thousands of these other soldiers, tens of thousands of the other soldiers, hundreds of thousands of the other soldiers, William Dame, a soldier who surrendered to Grant's troops, later wrote of his journey home and what he described as the 180-mile walk to get there. Now, as these soldiers trudged home, families were reunited, perhaps much like the Virginia family photographed here. Now, there's a version of this talk where we could just spend the whole time talking about that experience, about the process of going home, about the initial return. But we know, in a post-Vietnam era, a world in which conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan have gone on for so many years, we know that the impact of wars lasts long past their official end dates. Right, past that initial return of veterans. We know that that wars change the people who serve in them, and we know that their families are also affected for years and decades. So that gets to the subtitle to tonight's talk, right? Virginia's white Civil War veterans, their families, and a Southern welfare system. You know you're in trouble when an academic isn't happy with just one subtitle, but has to go to a sub-subtitle, so strap in. When we talk about the impact of the Civil War on the soldiers that fought, we often talk about the dead, and with good reason, right? As many of you may be well aware, several years ago, scholar J. David Hacker argued that historians have actually been underreporting the number of white men who died in the Civil War by 100,000 or maybe even 200,000 people. So what was already America's most deadly war was even more deadly than we've believed for 150 years. Now, unfortunately, given the limitations of the methods that Hacker used, and I was one of the historians, they had proof it before it was published, and we only have the aggregate number, right, of 750,000 dead. We don't know how many of them were Confederates. We don't know how many of them were Union soldiers. We don't even know. Some of them might not even have been in the military at all, but we do have approximate numbers for the dead in the South, which are staggering on their own, and they're almost certainly, given Hacker's study, they're likely on the lower end of actual numbers of people who died. But nearly 20% of white men of military age in the South are dead at the end of the war, right? 20% of white men of military age are dead. So one out of five Southern white men is dead by 1865, which is horrible, absolutely, and there's plenty of reason for us to talk about that. But even in the South, where a larger percentage of men survived than in the North, and for longer average terms of service, even there, that still means that 80% of those men survived the war and came home. And in most cases, their family members at home survived the war as well. So this project really began out of me wondering, what would surviving Southern white families do in the post-war period? Where would they turn for help in a post-war South? So I wanted to explore the attempt to deal with the human consequences of death. Human consequences of war. Death, of course, woundings, amputations, illnesses, and also what we now call post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, in 19th century America, families were the basic unit, and they continued on even with when one or more of their members died. So I wanted to explore how they went on. War's end did not mean family's end, right? So early in my research, I ran across these words by a Reverend Minister Holmes of Danville, Virginia, in 1875. And he wrote, "It is well to raise monuments to the dead, but I think it is far better to take care of the living." Right? Now, given the controversy over monuments recently, which is not what this talk is about, this phrasing takes on a whole new meaning. Maybe we can talk about later. But at the time, I just reacted to that larger notion here, right? I suspected that Holmes was not alone in these sentiments, and so I wanted to look further at those who took care of the living, right? And so that's the premise of the book. So how to do that? Now, unfortunately, we're really talking analyzing every veteran family isn't really realistic, even if you just focus on one state, Virginia. That's logistically overwhelming. So I'm going to try to talk broadly tonight about, where possible, about the experiences of Virginia's veteran families and the places they turn for support. I'm going to supplement that with some very specific data on the impact of war and the effect of that support through the lens of a particular Virginia community, in this case, Pennsylvania County, in Danville, Virginia, and the 3,400 soldiers and families who fought. Now we can talk about the typicality of that and whether these are truly representative. But suffice it to say that men from that area of the state were involved in most of the major battles of the East, including making up 10% of Pickett's division at Gettysburg. All right, so 10% of Pickett's division of Gettysburg was from a single county. Right, Pennsylvania County. Now, the fact that county also included the last capital of the Confederacy meant that the area has an additional symbolic role as representative of the Confederate soldier and veteran. Right. All right. Now, the area has pretty high casualties, but it also is largely untouched by battles. Right. So you don't have the same kind of property damage that you'd have in, say, where I work every day, Fredericksburg. Right? And so, given my interest in the human impact of war, right, this was a really good place to look. Large numbers of men who fought, but the property themselves, the property that they lived on, was not damaged. So some of the individual impact statistics I'll talk about come from a massive database that I created for my book, which if you buy it, you don't have to read. I'd like you to read the book. You don't have to read the database. So the database is based on military service records, as well as the 1860 and 1870 manuscript population census, which I hand entered in. For every person who lived in the county, right? And then Ancestry.com came along. They'd just been 10 years earlier. But I did it all by myself, and then actually linked the soldiers to their families, and then linked the families from 1860 to 1870, right? So then complemented that with letters, diaries, records from state pensions and churches, as well as the mental institution in Stanton that was known at the time as the Western Lunatic Asylum. So tonight I'm going to focus on these Virginia families, Virginia veteran families who were hit worst by the war, those who had suffered economic ruin, physical damage, and devastating psychological consequences, those who found it difficult, even impossible, to rebuild on their own. Now, of course, we need to recognize that not everyone was affected so severely, right? But these extreme examples provide insight for us into the long-term impact of Civil War service, the long-term impact of on not just veterans, but on their families as well. And it was the extreme cases, combined with the sheer numbers of people who needed help in the years and decades after the war, that forced society to recognize and adapt to the consequences of the war, leading to what I've called a rudimentary Southern welfare system. But let's just start with a few examples of Virginians who were affected by the war. I try to do this for the book. Combine the aggregate data with stories of individuals. All right. So in 1861 and 1862, James Redd, William Dix, and Joseph Miller all enlisted in Virginia regiments of the Confederate Army. So too did George and James, the husbands of Bathsheba Adams and Jane Smith. Now by the end of the war, Smith and Adams' husbands were dead. Redd had been wounded, and Miller had lost his leg midway between the knee and ankle at Gettysburg, was captured, and spent a year as a Union prisoner of war. By 1870, Dix's family had lost 80% of their 1860 wealth, nearly $10,000. Beset with financial difficulties for many years, Dix attempted suicide. So I think we can agree, for these five soldiers and their families, the Civil War had brought significant consequences. And these families are just the tip of the impact of the war on white Virginians. Simply and broadly put, families whose husbands, fathers, and brothers and sons served in the Confederate Army were affected demographically, economically, and psychologically for the rest of their lives by the impact of the Civil War. Now, some of the aspects of that impact are easily quantifiable during and immediately after the war, at least on the county level. Accurate state and region numbers are still hard for us to come by. Military records, for example, provide some aggregate sense of the impact on Pennsylvania and Danville's soldiers. So, for example, nearly four-fifths of the county's men of military age served in frontline Confederate units, almost 80%. One-fourth of the county's soldiers died during the conflict. Another half suffered wounds, diseases, or imprisonment. Rough counting suggests that about 12% of the county's soldiers had an amputated limb or a limb that was damaged so severely that they were able to later get a pension equivalent to amputation. So over 2,400 of the county's soldiers, a staggering 74% of the soldiers and 59% of the county's white men in general, experienced something during the war that killed them, damaged them, or put them in a hospital or prison. So military impact, we can count things. Economic impact, we can too, especially if you spend 2 years entering data. Right? So generally speaking, during and after the war, we know that veteran families experienced significant financial declines in real and personal property because of emancipation, because of Southern economic depressions, and the temporary or permanent loss of the labor of men who had gone off to war. But we could be more precise about that economic impact using these databases for Pennsylvania and Danville. So one way to look at the economic impact of the war on veteran families is to look at land ownership. I was talking to E.B. before about his family, right? If we look again in 1860, what percentage of veteran families owned land in 1860, and what percentage of veteran families owned land in 1870? What we can see is that in 1860, 58% of households containing at least one future soldier owned real estate. By 1870, only 46% of veteran family households owned real estate. So about 12% of them lost land. We can also compare the experiences of veterans versus non-veterans. So if we compare the percentage amount of the county's total wealth that's held by veteran families in 1860 and the percentage of the wealth held by veteran families in 1870, what we see is that veteran families, and this is not surprising, but no one's ever sort of pulled this all together, veteran families are more severely affected by the economic impact of the Civil War than those who don't serve. Right. According to the 1860 population census, family members of households who would send soldiers to war owned almost 50% of the total property in the county. And by the 1870 census, veteran family households held only 30% of the wealth in the county. Right. This relative decline in control of wealth in the county, combined with a decline in individual household wealth, would have made it even more difficult for those veteran families to rebuild in the years after the war. And finally, these databases also allow us to do something else, right? And this is, I'm pretty sure this is the only chart I'm going to show you with numbers on it. They allow us to see how different experiences in the war affected these families' economic status, at least in the short term. So from 1860, the top line, sort of alive and healthy veteran families, alive not healthy, which is the category that I used to include basically everything else. Did they end up in a prison camp, right, which we know has all kinds of health effects? Did they register in the hospital in some way? We know Civil War soldiers had every reason not to go to the hospitals unless they were in bad shape. Were they wounded in some way, or did they? But in this case, they didn't die. So anything short of death, and then dead. So all families that have at least one soldier who died. So from 1860 to 1870, average total wealth for veteran families whose men came home alive and healthy, so no recorded wounds or diseases, dropped 74%. So just service meant dropping 74%, even if your husband or brother or father came home. But from 1860 to 1870, average total wealth for veteran families whose men came home alive but not healthy dropped 83%. Right? So whether it's illness, there's a lagging indicator here. But the interesting thing is that the difference between having someone who came home alive, not healthy, and someone who didn't come home at all is actually pretty close to the same impact, right? That the men who came home injured in some way, damaged in some way, continued to be a drain, continued to be a problem for their families to deal with, right? So that means that having a living but not healthy family member had virtually the same financial impact on veteran families as having lost a family member completely. As Confederate veteran W.H. Power noted in his pension application, wartime wounds to his right arm and leg meant, quote, "There are many things I can't do now that I am prevented from doing by the lameness which are necessary and which I used to do in laboring." You may or may not know, this is tobacco country, right? It's farming country. It's agricultural country. Later on, we see cotton mills in the Danville area. But at the time, this is fundamentally an agricultural area, a manual labor area. Now, of course, the economic impact was more than just the physical impact of wounding or illness of the war on soldiers. The Southern economy was devastated in the years after the Civil War. So even many healthy veterans were unable to pay their debts and found themselves in debtor's court in the post-war years. Still harder to, so we can do some quantification, but it takes a very patient historian and a very supportive wife. Other aspects of the impact of the Civil War are harder to quantify, including what we might describe as emotional, spiritual, psychological impact. Yet evidence, perhaps beyond computation, does exist that certainly reveals the difficulties of dealing with wartime problems, as well as all the changes that came with the post-war world. It's clear that emotionally and psychologically, members of veteran families suffered. They suffered from temporary wartime physical separations. They suffered from permanent losses of family and friends. They suffered from tensions that were caused by economic woes or physical or mental war damage. At a minimum, those changes place stress on Confederate veteran families. At worst, they left some of these families impoverished, dysfunctional, and in a few cases, put people in the care of a state mental institution. One example. Veteran William H. White was admitted to a mental hospital 30 years after the war, although the admitting doctor explicitly linked his mental troubles to his service. This is a quote from the medical record. "Ever since 1863 has been a little irregular in his mental condition, though of late the attacks have been more marked, though until recently he has been able to discharge his duties as a cashier of a bank. He used to call his attacks the Blue Devils. Has shown no tendency to do others harm. Evidence of insanity are that he thinks people are plotting against him to injure him and is noisy and quarrelsome." Asylum records from the war and decades later really just reveal the tip of the iceberg of the massive psychological impact of the Civil War. I say iceberg because the records of the state asylum represent the worst case scenarios. They represent people who were in such trouble or such distress that they that their communities couldn't care for them, their families couldn't care for them anymore, and that they were put up for a commitment to the state institution. But they are by no means all of those who were affected mentally by the war. So it's important to understand that many of these consequences, physical and psychological alike, stretch on for decades. State records reveal the long-term impact of the war on these veteran families. Pension request applications reveal ongoing financial problems 20, 30, 40 years later. Those same applications reflect ongoing and exacerbated physical problems as veterans aged. Now, if we had to summarize what veterans tried to do after the war and what the families of those veterans tried to do, they tried to keep to a minimum the changes that the war and all of its consequences brought. That first meant surviving, then rebuilding their families using a variety of strategies. The institutions and the people to which these families turned for assistance in their attempt to prevent or minimize or cope with the significant physical, economic, and emotional consequences of the war reveal a post-war world that was fraught with difficult choices. All right. So what I really want to spend the rest of my time talking about is, what are those strategies? What did people do to try to rebuild their families, to survive in that post-war world? So the first place that they turned, really, was to their own families, right? To their nuclear family and to their extended family, right? But we can sort of go out from there. And I sort of conceive of this aid as going in circles, right? It starts with the family itself, and then it moves out to other local forms of assistance, traditional local sources of aid like churches, right? Like local rich people, right? And then it goes further out, right? To the state. And this is where I see the building really of a virtual social welfare system for Virginia's Confederate families. So that included sending psychologically damaged family members to a state-run asylum, or looking to the state for direct assistance in the form of replacement limbs for amputees, or pensions, or even state-supported homes for old soldiers and for soldiers' widows. Now, these forms of assistance, especially local ones, were not new. They had their roots in previous practices. But the fact is, the sheer scale of the Civil War broke all those systems, right? The extreme need of veteran families just simply stretched them to the breaking point. Confederate veteran families participated in and helped cause a gradual expansion from a reliance on an older system of family, friends, churches, and local elites to the rise of a state-based system of support, a paternal state, which replaced some of the functions of individual families and eventually resulted in a wide-ranging state social welfare system. All right, so let's talk about families. Home was the place to which soldiers wanted to return. Letters, as many of you have read, I'm sure, back and forth between the home front and the battle front, indicated that soldiers constantly thought about home, they wrote about home, they wanted to be home, and they wanted to get home and to see their family members, they wanted to return their lives, they wanted to be nurtured within the strong emotional economic support of the network of familial households. And that included not just their nuclear family, but friends, extended relatives, right? But again, the basic unit of economic and emotional support in the 19th century was the family household, right? At its most fundamental level, the rebuilding of veteran families required, as one household head wrote 3 years after the war, using every economy and working every way to get along, right? Whatever it took, try to figure out whatever you could. So it often meant choosing one or more of a variety of strategies intended to try to maximize your economic and emotional benefits. So these strategies included manipulating the family household structure, right? Particularly important for soldiers' widows, right? Attempting to succeed in farming or other work in the post-war, post-slavery world by using the labor of all family members, something that wouldn't have been done or not done very often in the pre-war time. It might mean moving away from Pennsylvania County and Danville. It might mean turning to friends and relatives outside the home. Maybe you move in with family members, right? Now, there are a number of weaknesses to this strategy, most notably, this puts a lot of strain on a family, right? It makes it very hard for family members when everyone is trying to do anything they can, and some people are doing things that were outside the norm, that weren't things that would have been seen as appropriate or acceptable in the antebellum period. They're now having to do these things in the postbellum period. So just as one example, many women had to work outside the home to support their families in the postbellum period, something that would have been avoided as much as possible in the antebellum world, right? And in fact, In many of these families, it looks like women are ultimately the main breadwinner in the years after the war, right? That action challenges the gender conventions of the day, makes it harder in some ways, makes the tension increase in these families. In some ways, it's amazing that veteran families were able to survive at all. But in the end, we know that relatives and friends and families themselves fail to provide enough support in every veteran family's life. How do we know that? Because so many of them turned elsewhere for support. When they looked beyond the family, they looked beyond their friends, right? So they turned initially to these long-standing local support systems, right? Churches and elite community members. So, the nature of the aid of churches varied wildly, right? I looked at something like 55 different churches and looked at their records for a 20-year period. I focused on the Baptists because they were the largest denomination in Pennsylvania County in Danville. So it varied depending on the resources of the congregation, depended on the willingness of the congregation. For most Confederate veteran families who were members, Baptist churches provided them at a minimum with emotional and spiritual support, right? And in some cases as well, economic support. For some of the desperately needy, typically these were widows and orphans, churches did offer limited financial assistance, even the occasional job. And at times, Baptist churches seem to take on responsibilities such as education, which were previously restricted to families. That was something the family would have done themselves. We also see a pretty massive increase in church membership during and after the Civil War, right? Nearly doubling in size between 1861 and 1880, church membership in the county. And that, I think, indicates that many veteran families found something useful or fulfilling in those religious communities, at a minimum, economic, psychological, religious support. But they also turned to local elites, right? And I love this quote. And it's not just because Grief Lampkin is the most Southern name that I could find. So, right? It's right at Absalom, I swear. But, in any case, Virginia's upper class made up another part of the local support network of the community, right? Some of the elite were devastated economically, but not all of them were. Southern men and women had long looked to rich people in their community for assistance in tough times. During and after the Civil War, elite men and women took on renewed importance as potential sources of cash or job opportunities or influence. Now, members of the upper class could and did refuse to give their assistance, but many veteran families have felt they had nothing to lose by asking, right? Asking the wealthy for help, especially when other sources of aid had failed them, and some of those petitions for help have survived, right? And so, to get at this issue, I looked at decades of appeals for help to one of these men, William T. Sutherland, who is one of the state's richest men, right? He was a tobacco manufacturer. He was later the founder of the cotton mills in Danville. He was a farm owner. He was a railroad magnate. He was a mayor. He was a Civil War quartermaster. He was a bank president, and he was a politician, right? So not surprising, given all the hats that he wore, he received many requests from people for jobs, for money, for the use of influence on their behalf. And many of these requests came from people who are in truly dire need. Veteran William Baugh, wounded at Gettysburg in the Battle of 7 Days, explained that he needed Sutherland's help in a job at Danville's toll bridge because, quote, "I am disabled and must go at something else besides hard labor." So he wanted his influence in getting a job basically being a toll taker, right? And there are many others, just unbelievably heart-wrenching to read, decades worth of appeals. What you find when you look at these petitions collectively, and especially those that he approved, is that a new category of worthy had emerged in the post-war period, that of the Confederate veteran family, right? And evidence of this can be seen in the success rate of Confederate veteran petitions to Sutherland. Over 82% of the successful appeals for help, of the appeals that he agreed to, over 82% came from veteran families, right? As compared to 57% of veteran families within the overall pool. Right? He's clearly favoring veteran families in the decisions that he's making. And there are limits here too, right? Sutherland had to turn many people down. At one point, his aide wrote back to a petitioner, "He esteems you highly and would, if convenient, be gratified to comply with your request. But the present stringency of money matters is very great. And besides this fact, the major, as he liked to be called but really didn't deserve, the major has been for some time past loaning out and otherwise using large amounts of funds and has been receiving nothing in return. Therefore, under these circumstances, it will not be convenient for him to accommodate you at present," right? Often quite formal. So even William T. Sutherland, one of the richest men in the state, even after the war, couldn't help everyone who asked him for assistance. He seems to have turned down nearly 3/4 of the people who wrote to him asking for help in some way. Now add to that that many of his fellow elites in the South had not survived the war quite so cleanly, many of the fellow rich in the South had been financially devastated by the war and by emancipation. And we can see that the long-standing system of elite aid to the needy was severely strained, if not broken, by the post-war crisis. And so, we have to go further out from the county. We have to go to the state of Virginia. So, the failure of old sources of private assistance in the face of such widespread need resulted in unprecedented involvement by the state government in providing support for Confederate veterans and their families. And I'll talk about more traditional notions of assistance to Confederate veteran families, such as pensions and veterans and widows' homes in just a minute. But first, I want to make an argument that a relatively new institution in the 19th century, the mental asylum, was a non-traditional form of state welfare that served some Confederate veterans and their families. Specifically, veteran families looked to Eastern and Western Lunatic Asylum, later known as Eastern and Western State Hospitals, in Williamsburg and Stanton. Now, it's important to understand, one of my professors at Mary Washington and then a colleague of mine at Mary Washington grew up in Danville. And when he heard that I was working on this, he said that when he was growing up in Danville, one of the things that people would say if someone was acting off in some way was like, "Oh, that guy's going to Stanton," right? That was sort of like it became a kind of shorthand for mental illness. I'm sure the people in Stanton love that, but. By the way, does anyone know what the lunatic asylum in Stanton is now?
Western State.
Well, now that moved, and Western State Hospital did continue on for many years, but the original building, is condos and a spa. Right? So I think we failed that preservation. I know that's not in our area wheelhouse, but I just have to say, I don't want to go to sleep at a mental institution, no matter how nice the condo is now. But
It's actually kind of a pretty condo.
It's a beautiful area. It actually, yeah. So there's a whole separate talk about mental institutions in Stanton and Virginia in particular. But so it's important for us to understand that although many Virginians seem to have suffered from what was considered mental illness, not everyone with the apparent psychological problems went to an insane asylum, right? Relatives usually attempted to care for family members with psychological disorders. Only if their behavior was violent, or if they wandered off, or if their family just couldn't take care of them, would the mentally ill be first put in the local jail, right? Not an ideal place. And then commitment to a state asylum be considered. The records of Western Lunatic Asylum, including admissions books and medical charts, certainly suggest the Civil War and its aftermath had a significant psychological effect on some veteran families. The antebellum support system broke down under the trauma and stress of the conflict and its consequences, and veteran family members with mentally ill relatives turned to the state for help. Virginia's asylums became part of this post-war system, which the state took on new responsibilities that families were unable to fulfill. caring for or even curing, and I hope you hear the air quotes around curing men and women apparently affected by the war. So I identified over 70 people at Western Lunatic Asylum who are part of veteran families, many of them with admissions records that list the cause of their insanity as simply the war.
Wow.
All right? So again, we have this sense that our understanding of the psychological impact of war is really something we only have talked about after Vietnam. But in fact, psychologists in the 1860s had made that connection. They understood the traumatic psychological impact of war, right? So for most of these patients, their medical records directly link their mental problems to some kind of involvement in the Civil War. Now, I want to be careful here. That's not to say the conflict necessarily caused all of their mental illnesses. Even today, our understanding of the causes of mental problems remain less than perfect. And reading 19th century asylum records will not give you faith in humanity. But from the view of the patient's relatives and the doctors at the Western State Hospital, there are clear links between the Civil War and its consequences and the mental problems that these Virginians suffered during this period. So these conditions included simply military service, the realities of military service, the death of loved ones, the results of the war, in other words, the fact that the South lost, and the post-war economic, social, and political conditions. And I also want to be careful to point out it's dangerous to impose modern diagnoses on people in the past, but I'm going to do it. It's hard not to see numerous connections between the symptoms of these men and women and what we now call post-traumatic stress disorder, including one veteran's, quote, impatience, fretfulness, violence of temper, and loss of mental power. I would add, in reference to my earlier comment about the iceberg here, certainly not everyone reacted to the war and its aftermath with such force that their friends, families, neighbors had them committed to an asylum. But there are numerous tales of depression and violence seen in men and women across the post-war South that suggest pretty clearly to me, and not just to me, but to other researchers as well, that white Southerners paid a fairly significant psychological and emotional toll. All right. Now, the goal of 19th century asylums was to cure or care for the mentally ill. About 64% of the sample patients' mental conditions improved to the point that the medical staff believed they could be discharged to their family or friends. The rest of them either ran away or died at the asylum, some immediately, others after decades there. Still, while sometimes a discharge meant that a person could and did return to their life, cured in this case just really meant that the person was no longer a danger to themselves or others, right? And there are also drawbacks. First, 19th century asylums were not a place you wanted to be if you could help it. Economically speaking, in addition to losing the labor of the committed family member, families were expected to help pay for his or her upkeep. Again, this is a state institution, but they were expected to contribute. Now, in reality, I found almost no evidence of families actually paying that. They got bills for it from the state, but in most cases, the state seems to have picked up the tab. Emotionally speaking, there was a pretty high level of stigma to having a family member who had been committed to an asylum. This is something we struggle with even today, right? And over time, the focus of the asylum and other asylums in the nation shifted from quick release to long-term care, and the number of residents gradually grew over the decades. Now, trying to assess the value of the lunatic asylum for veteran families reveals a weakness of using the family as a unit of analysis, right? So I'm telling you where my analysis doesn't work, right? The problem is families consist of individuals, right? And the ability to put a family member in the asylum didn't mean the same thing to all members of the family. Like, if you were the person being put in the asylum, you might have different feelings about it than the people who are putting you in the asylum, right? Certainly for some patients, the strange surroundings, the limits on their freedom, the horrific treatments opium is the best of the things they treated people with. I'm happy in Q&A to talk through some of those concoctions. And the odd assortment of other people made that time in the asylum was itself traumatic, not curative for some. Still, despite some potential serious drawbacks for the individuals, Western State and other Virginia asylums were part of a post-war system in which the state took on more responsibilities in light of the failure of families to carry burdens that traditionally had been theirs to carry. But let me give you a sense of how the scope of this. In 1871, the Commonwealth of Virginia spent $190,000 on its asylums. By 1890, the state had doubled its spending to $380,000, which might not seem that much, except that you should know that it was 14% of the state budget for that year. All right? And by the 50th anniversary of Gettysburg in 1913, the asylums cost the state over $715,000 a year. Now, it'd be a stretch to say that the expansion in funding and the parallel increases in the numbers of people in the state asylums was solely due to the Civil War. It's not. There's a lot of larger trends going on in the treatment of mental illness. But it's no coincidence that the increases happen after a number of commentators referred to the increasing need for assistance to help the mentally ill, and after the Eastern Lunatic Asylum reported to the governor in 1870, insanity seems to have increased since the war. Now, in addition to the expansion of mental institutions, we can also see the rise of a social welfare system and the arrival of more traditional state aid. Right? Through a series of post-war acts passed by Virginia's General Assembly, the state built on wartime relief efforts to provide financially for the soldiers and families who had most severely borne the burden of the Civil War. They began in a limited way with amputees, those survivors most physically harmed by the war. But starting in the late 1880s, Virginia legislators widened the scope of financial assistance to include all veterans disabled by war, widows widowed by war, veterans disabled by age, and widows whose veteran husbands died after the war. Now, the real reason the first Virginia pension bill was passed in 1888, though, also has to do with the political context of Virginia during this time period. Now, for much of the 1870s, Virginia's Conservative Party, also known as the Democrats, cut funds to state programs like schools in order to pay off state debts. But from 1879 to 1883, there's a biracial political movement in Virginia called the Readjusters, and they want to readjust the state debt. It's a whole other book to be written about the Readjusters. But it's no coincidence that we see an increase in the 1890s and the 1900s, 1880s, 1890s, and 1900s of Confederate pensions, because part of what the state legislators are doing is trying to consolidate, trying to divide that biracial political coalition and trying to consolidate some of their power, right? And in fact, after 1883, the Readjusters are kicked out and the Democrats take over again. Ultimately, though, Virginia's Confederate pensions allow the state to care for an aging, often damaged, needy population of veteran families, to create systems that built on earlier and Union examples, and to embrace the lost cause in Confederate memory in politically useful ways. Virginia also provided homes for elderly and disabled veterans, veteran widows, and even veteran daughters. The most prominent of these was the Lee Camp Soldiers Home, started in 1885 and mostly state-funded by 1886, and the Home for Needy Confederate Women, which was opened in 1900. And there in Richmond for a number of years. The Home for Needy Confederate Women was open until the 1980s. Okay. Does anybody know where that is in Richmond?
Behind where the Soldiers' Home was, the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts.
That's right. Virginia Museum of Fine Arts is the location. So that location, Battle Abbey, where the VHS is, right? That was the location. But it's the 1980s, and they actually moved, I think, 9 Confederate daughters into a nursing home. The state did to finally, in the 1980s, shut it down. Again, the long legacy of the Civil War. But in doing this, in creating these homes and the pensions, the state of Virginia created a limited social welfare system where one had not existed before, but it was one that was just for those who were considered to be worthy, these veterans and their families. Just to give you a sense, now, Virginia was not as generous as say Georgia, but During this era, late 1880s into the early 1900s, Virginia spent between 3 and 10% of its annual budget on Confederate welfare, on money directly going either to pensions or amputees or to these soldiers' homes or widows' homes, right? 50 years after the war, there were still 9,000 veterans and 5,000 Confederate widows on the pension rolls of the Commonwealth of Virginia, and nearly 300 veterans living in the Richmond Soldiers' Home. So Georgia's was the most generous. Georgia, North Carolina, and Tennessee all spent more on their Confederate veteran families than Virginia did. And Georgia's was the most generous. They had the most generous pensions, right? Still, we need to remember that for most veterans and widows, the financial benefits from the state supplemented. They did not replace the networks of family and local support that I mentioned earlier. And the amounts that the state gave were much less than the money spent by the federal government on union pensions. Right. So in rough terms, and this is it doesn't always work out exactly, but in rough terms, the annual amount paid to a Virginia pensioner was the monthly amount paid to a Union pensioner. Right. Still, although Virginia's Civil War pensions never paid enough to replace the income of a healthy male laborer, that does not mean that the money wasn't important to those families. It clearly was. And for many, it may have been enough to keep them out of the poorhouse. The state's assistance was badly needed, avidly sought, and gratefully welcomed by veterans and their families. So as an illustrative example, let's talk about Joseph Miller, who I mentioned at the start of our discussion. In 1871, Miller, an amputee and a POW from Gettysburg, applied for and received one of the artificial limbs that Virginia offered to its amputees. He wore the leg for 13 years, although he had to, and these are his words, had to have it repaired using $40 he got from the state for that purpose in 1880. In 1884, however, the wooden leg, and this quoting from his application, the wooden leg had the misfortune to break again. Right? And at this point, Miller was too poor to get it fixed. But once again, the state approved his application for financial aid, although they waited 2 years after his application to give it to him, this time awarding him $60 as a commutation and to repair the artificial limb. In 1897, Miller applied for a pension under Virginia's 1888 Pension Act, asking for the standard $30 annual payments allowed to single-limb amputees. Well, not only was his application approved, but the auditor's office granted him an unusual $50 annual pension, which he apparently received for the rest of his life. So Joseph T. Miller took advantage of almost all the financial opportunities the state of Virginia offered to its veterans, though he didn't stay at Lee Camp Soldiers' Home, but pretty much everything else. And the aid provided to Miller seems to have made his life after the war at least a little easier. The artificial leg likely allowed him some improvement in mobility, perhaps even in his labor. The commutation and money awarded him to repair his wooden leg aided him as well. The pension he received allowed him the chance to pay some of the debts undoubtedly accumulated by his young family after he could not do manual labor to any significant extent, just as his three children were still under the age of 13 when his artificial limb first broke. Virginia's financial aid had clearly made a difference in Miller's life. He and his family could have argued that the state he fought and sacrificed for had not forgotten him. In fact, it celebrated his service. And many Confederate veterans and their families found that these artificial limbs, commutations, pensions, and homes had a similar impact. But Miller was only one of the five families I began with earlier this evening. What about the other four? Well, even though I've described a kind of Confederate state welfare, especially in the form of pensions, homes, asylums, and artificial limbs, I want to be clear that I don't think we should see the Confederate veteran families as mere recipients of state government largesse. The architects of these programs and many of those who applied for them framed them as payment for services rendered, not charity. Plus, many Confederate veteran families would have resisted the label of victim. Certainly none of the members of those five veteran families I started with passively accepted their lot. They each employed strategies intended to maintain or reconstruct their families during and after the conflict. I just talked about Joseph Miller's advocacy for himself. In addition, James Redd appealed for assistance to a member of the local elite, while Bathsheba Adams and Jane Smith turned to their churches and families for emotional and financial support. In the aftermath of his suicide attempt, William Dix's family sent him to the Western Lunatic Asylum, from which he returned 19 months later, apparently recovered. In the first years of the 20th century, James Redd entered the Lee Camp Soldiers Home, a state-supported home for disabled and elderly Confederate veterans. Like thousands of Pennsylvania's veteran families, these men and women looked to a variety of ways to cope with the consequences of the Civil War that often transcended the structure of their families. We shouldn't overstate these options, however. Financial aid was limited in its scope, and non-financial aid forms of aid did not always work out for the members of veteran families. Local forms of aid broke under the strain of so many worthy needy. And even at the state level, Confederate social welfare was far from perfect. So although William Dix was released from prison after 19 months, others were there for years and in what seems to us today to be horrific conditions. And James Redd was kicked out of the Lee Camp Soldiers Home just a few months after his admission for drinking and swearing. Even with all the forms of assistance available to Confederate veteran families after the war, for some families, their fight was a losing battle, particularly if family members had died or had been severely handicapped by wartime injuries or illness. Still, many of Virginia's veteran families survived the war, rebuilt their lives and their fortunes with the help of their families, their relatives, their friends, their communities, and especially their state. And receiving aid was about more than just financial assistance. We should be clear about that. Virginia's veteran families also found affection from family members, other relatives and friends, spiritual and emotional support from church communities, a place to care for mentally ill family members, and recognition from their communities and the state for the sacrifices that they had made. And although the aid in all of its forms failed to restore veteran families to their pre-war position, most of them adapted in some form to the new postbellum world. Now, Virginia's Confederate welfare system lasted longer than you might expect. The last Confederate soldiers' home resident died in 1941. The last Confederate veteran pensioner died in 1959. The home for needy Confederate women, as I said, finally closed in 1989, with the remaining daughters of Confederate soldiers being transferred to an elderly care facility in Richmond, where that last daughter died in 1997. And with that ended Virginia's system of Confederate social welfare, more than 130 years after the conflict. Thank you. We've got a few minutes for questions. Yeah.
Yeah, just one interesting one I thought, and the idea of rebuilding, but the 14th Amendment, Section 4, what kind of a damaging or negative effect did this have? Because it had right up there saying, sure, the debt incurred in putting down the rebellion,
yeah,
shall not be questioned. Taxation, anything living as that, that would be, you know, vigorously enforced and should be supported.
Right.
But the debt incurred or any of the hardship by the rebellious nature,
right,
you know, whatever, however the word,
right,
get the exact words,
yeah,
you want to use, they weren't positive words.
That's right.
And would not only not be paid by the federal government,
right,
but they forbade the states from providing any of this aid at all.
That's correct, and it was never enforced in Virginia.
Okay.
Right. So,
yeah.
I mean, initially it is.
Right.
I should take that back.
But, 1868.
But by the time of redemption, yeah, when the Democrats take power again in Virginia, which is pretty early, 1869, 1870, they actually move pretty quickly to begin to try to pay off what they, mm-hmm, see as the rightful debt that the, mm-hmm, that they owe. Now, it more or less cripples the economy. It's something like 30% of the annual state revenues go, mm-hmm, to paying off Confederate war debt. So that's part of why the readjuster movement is actually successful, because there's a bunch of people who would say, well, let's build some schools, let's build trains, let's invest in industry, right? Mm-hmm. But no, it doesn't. I mean, there's some talk about the 14th Amendment and that, mm-hmm, and that particular provision, but there doesn't seem to be the heart in the North to actually enforce that particular rule. So, oh wow, lots. Okay.
In fact, when your wealth changes,
yeah,
what was the percentage of slaves in that county, and,
yeah,
how did that, obviously they were,
sure, that's a significant portion of the real property.
Mm-hmm.
So I've looked at it in a couple of different ways. About 50% of the wealth loss is probably in enslaved people. So that's a big chunk of it. There's no question. It's a slave heavy community.
What did the returning veterans do for employment?
Yeah. Well, this is part of the problem. I mean, at least initially, there does seem to be a kind of depression or malaise. There aren't a lot of options. In the initial year or two, they're dependent on whatever method their families have sort of used to get by. So, see lots of elite or formerly elite women moving into teaching, for example. This is really when the feminization of the teaching profession emerges. If they're capable, if they're physically capable, they far. In a variety of ways. Depends on whether or not they own land, depends on whether or not they have access to the supplies they need. A lot of the really early letters to William T. Sutherland are basically requests to get a loan, to get them started for the agricultural cycle. But for others, if they're injured in some way, bank teller is one of the ones that we see people moving to, the toll takers. It depends on what sort of options they have. If you were a lawyer before the war, you can continue to be a lawyer after the war, and we do see some amputees and war veterans do that. But there just aren't a whole lot of options, and the tobacco market does eventually take off again. But tobacco itself, I won't get too deep into the literal weeds of this, Danville is a bright leaf tobacco area, and there is a switch to bright leaf tobacco over the course of the war for a variety of reasons. And so you do begin to see within about 5 or 6 years the tobacco warehouses in Danville coming to life again. What's different though is that much like with cotton farming, a lot of the labor is being done in more like sharecropping than it is sort of big farms.
So literacy would play a role in that.
Yeah, absolutely. Remember, there's no public school system before the Civil War, and so lots of people are not literate, and so and your options would certainly be much more limited if you didn't have literacy. Yeah.
In the North, following the war, later 19th century, you have a number of fraternal organizations.
Mm-hmm. The time is now 8:30.
Things like that.
The library closes.
What happens in the South?
I'm sorry. So fraternal organizations in the North.
Fraternal organizations that act as insurers.
Yes.
Or library.
Yes.
Please be a staff member.
Yes, you do see there are fraternal organizations in the South. Some of them are continuing from the pre-war communities. They do some basic insurance, but honestly, the entire insurance industry in the state is completely wiped out by the war. Honestly, because most of them invested in Confederate bonds, and so what's inflation? Something like 7,000% by the end of the war, and so. And then, of course, they're not allowed to accept right. Confederate money, and so there is. We do see sort of a restarting of that. You do see some northern infusion of capital from northern insurance companies, but the mutual aid associations take a much basically have to start completely over and rebuilding their nest eggs and rebuilding the basic funds. But you do see them. You do see them reemerge. It just takes a while.
So we've got these asylums around the state of Virginia. Mm-hmm. Who were the employee demographics of those asylums?
Who worked in them?
Yes, correct.
Yeah. So each one emerges in very different ways. So Eastern Lunatic Asylum begins actually in the 1700s. It's one of the first asylums in the nation. And it pretty explicitly is integrated. Racially integrated, and so it has a staff that is racially integrated. Western Lunatic Asylum was explicitly all white, but there are a number of orderlies, and the doctors are all white, and the nurses are typically all white, but a lot of the staff are black. And part of that is it's pretty horrible work. It's not great to be in the asylum. It's also not terrific work to do it. I will say my next project is on Western State Hospital, and when the readjusters come in and take over the state government for 4 years, they do what all 19th century state governments do, which is they appoint all their own people in every single state position, right? So they fire everybody all the way down to the orderlies. And then they reward, so all the people who get appointed are actually basically members of the readjuster party. About a year after that, there's eight of the inmates, as they call them, are poisoned, and six of them die, and the governor of Virginia and the readjuster-appointed superintendent is convinced that this is a plot by the Democrats to get back into power. And so they send they hire a Pinkerton detective to come in as an undercover patient. And so I have 6 months of this guy's reports. So that's the next book. And I assume the movie rights will pay for my kids to go to college. Yeah, right here.
How long did it take for the people of the North to finally accept people from the South taking jobs? I would think that there were a lot of jobs in the North, but they wouldn't accept them socially.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what you mean?
As a result of the war.
Yeah, I mean, I think for the most part, there are Northerners, there are Southerners who leave the South, but for the most part, Southerners who leave go west, yeah. Right? Texas more than anywhere else, but and so they're typically around other Southerners, and so, there's a whole separate story about a Northern and Southern reconciliation and why that happens and how that happens and how thorough it happens, but I don't have time to go through it all tonight, so, yeah.
Did the state of Virginia do anything for the free enslaved people?
The short answer to that is no. The longer answer is that we do see in the emergence of these pensions some... A very few pensions for what are called loyal servants. But it all happens right at the same time as the readjuster movement is happening, and there's this biracial coalition. And so the historians who have studied the readjusters really sort of place that within a particular attempt to sort of split off African American votes from this biracial coalition. Most of the aid that's done for, and in fact, so by defining aid for the state aid as specifically for Confederate veterans and their family members, they have created effectively a whites-only system. The federal government did provide some assistance to African Americans through the Freedmen's Bureau for a number of years, but for the most part, the state was not particularly interested in assisting African Americans. The one thing you do see that emerges is the creation of a central lunatic asylum, which is created largely for African Americans.
Related to the present time or the recently present time, is the Western Hospital you mentioned mm-hmm. the same? I used to work for Community Services
right.
Board, and that's closed, and I'm sorry
that's right.
I don't know when it closed.
Yeah.
It was going on in 1985.
Right.
And I know my sister's husband's brother, 17 years before he could even get a group home.
Right.
Totally, because I was in that department. Is it the same hospital?
It is the same, administratively, it's the same hospital. They moved locations to the one that's right off of the, is it 250? And then as part of the sort of movement away from in the 1990s and early 2000s, they shut down what was Western State Hospital. But I was when I first started doing research on it, I was actually doing research in the unheated cinder block room that they called their archive, including amazingly enough, I just couldn't get them to let me take it somewhere, including Edison wax cylinders, which were audio transcripts of interviews with patients.
Did they work?
I was never, I mean, they were there in the unheated, right, unclimate controlled. Since when they closed, all of that material went to the state archives. which is a good thing. The bad thing is that then the state decided that under HIPAA, all of that material was protected information. And so I buttered up the, I, no, even, no, no, it, I, they said all, all, forever, is what the initial decision was. And so their historians have actually had to go to court in Connecticut and in New York and in Georgia to try to get this. But I buttered up the archivist of Virginia. And so I have a 100-year moving window on those records. So, yeah.
In your study group, did you find rates of alcoholism and drug use?
Yes. I mean, this is one of those areas where it's really hard to tell. And actually, the union has much better numbers in part because they have more soldiers' homes, but it's the soldiers' homes where you really see it, right? So, because people get kicked out for them. But anecdotally, yes, absolutely, throughout. I mean, first of all, the Baptists don't particularly like people drinking. They don't like them dancing either, but they're not just not an equivalent of alcoholism to dancing. But both of them will get you kicked out of the Baptist churches of Pennsylvania County in the 1870s. But yeah, absolutely. There's no question that some soldiers are self-medicating. And again, the addiction issues are a little more prevalent on the North because they tended to have more access to opium during the war. And ether and other things. And so Union soldiers were more likely to be addicted in that way. But alcoholism is a rampant problem in the 19th century. I'm trying to think. Just the ballpark numbers, like average per person consumption of alcohol in the U.S. now is like 2 gallons a year, and in the post-war years it's like 10 gallons a year. So yeah, right. Yeah, it's yeah.
In the pre-war era, county governments had a big role in taking care of the poor with the poorhouse.
Yep.
Poor farm, right. And aid to widows and children, right. And whatnot. Was that system still operating?
Completely breaks in Pennsylvania County because of the war. There is some reestablishment of it afterwards, but it really does. It just completely breaks down. It was never a particularly robust system, and it always dealt with the most needy. But I don't even talk about it because there's virtually no Confederate veteran families who get help from it in the post-war years. So he stood up, so I assume that was.
on behalf of the grateful roundtable.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. You've been a great audience. Thank you. Thank you.
Now we have to scramble.
Yes.
That's our deal.